another 2 year cycle.
Okay, so let us. Well, I also try to come up with new things. Okay, so let's. Since we started talking about Hidden Tamar yesterday, so let's do that maybe for one more day. So something that Zev does know from last year, but this you have to say every year, so let me get it out, but then maybe say some new things. Fundamentally, the problem with the Yehudah Tamar Perek is that it appears smack in the middle of the Yosef story in a way that it really makes basically no sense. Like, you could really go from Perek Lamed Zayin to Lamed Tet, and no one would notice that Perek Lamed Chet was cut out if you didn't know it was there, right? I mean, the last pasuk of Lamed Zayin is "Va'midanim machro tol Mitzrayim lefotifar sris paro sarat habachim," right? And the pasuk Lamed Tet, Perek Lamed Tet pasuk Aleph is "V'yosefu rad Mitzrayim lekneu potifar sris paro sarat habachim ish Mitzrayim bad mishmila sheridur shama." The only thing that you would ask is why is there a doubling, right? But like fundamentally, the story picks up like Perek Lamed Chet and everything goes on it, and it is strange, and that's why.
And that's basically what happens with kids. You know, if you leave the Yehudah and Tamar story out.
Correct. If you send your kid to a school where they skip Yehudah and Tamar, which,
yeah,
you know, at Meir school they do not. They make this very clear. That was literally the example they gave of that which they do not skip when I went to, or you know, open house for the school, is we learned the whole Chumash, including Yehudah and Tamar. Or when I was in elementary school, the way the Rebbe put it is, the BJE thinks you should skip this, but I think the story that leads to the birth of Mashiach is relatively important. So we learned it then also, so I've never skipped it. It is, but literally you would not know that it's missing. And the question becomes, why is it there? So there's a tremendous amount to say about the story. The broad contours of it is that, I think in a nutshell, is that the story of of Yosef, at the beginning of the story, is a story of brothers being willing to sell their brother into slavery, even kill him, because they begrudge him. And even the people who are not fully on board with the sale aren't really willing to take responsibility, right? Reuven takes somewhat responsibility. The Torah tells you that he plans on going and retrieving him from the pit, but he doesn't he isn't capable, either himself or just because of the situation. Again, we find out later on that he does seem to actually protest, but he doesn't successfully protest and get them to care about him. And then, by the second half of the story, you have the brothers, especially Yehudah, you know, who was the villain in the first half of the story, where he's literally the one who's pushing everything. By the end of the story, he's the one putting his life on the line to save Binyamin. I can't go back without him. Anochi arvenim yadi tevakshenu. Right, I will be his arev, I'll be the guarantor. And the question that you have to ask is, how did we get to that point? And the answer seems to be Perek Lamed Chet. Is that in Perek Lamed Chet, it starts off the same way, that Er dies, Onan doesn't want to take responsibility for his brother and his brother's legacy, so he refuses to consummate the marriage with Tamar, so he dies also. Then Yehudah refuses to take responsibility for both of his sons, and therefore lies to Tamar, and makes her wait while Shelah just grows up and never intends on giving to her. And then, you know, Tamar basically forces him into a Yibum situation through her deception, and then challenges him to recognize the items that he left with her, and then she, at the fateful moment, he says, "Tadkam Nimeni," she's right, and that seems to be the turning point, where he's capable of taking responsibility for his own family, even when it's hard, seems to be the beginning of his change, right? This is, in a nutshell, right, the everything from Vayeshev all the way through Vayigash, that is like the, and it all hangs on Perek, Lamed Chet. But let me make a few points in it that I think really push the way in which this is central to the story, and these are maybe things that Zev has not heard. The general point he has. But let's zoom in on it. So one way I think in which this is really really evident in a way that you have to know, right? You have to really pay attention to detail to see how much this is true, is what exactly the result is of Yehuda's ability to say Tzedkah Mimeni. Right? What exactly is the result? So, what is the result?
She doesn't die.
She doesn't die, and therefore what?
She has a kid.
Ah, so that's where it's not the right answer. The answer is he has
twins.
Twins! He has twins, and that's important. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because Yaakov and Esav were also...
So there's two reasons it's important, right? I'll get to what you said in a minute. One is local to the story, is that the birth of the twins makes up not just the death of Er, but right, not just the death of Onan, but the death of Er. Meaning Onan wasn't willing to take responsibility for Er, and therefore died. But now, because Onan wasn't willing to take responsibility for Er, he died too. So Yehuda had to take responsibility for both of his sons. Right? Remember, originally there was supposed to be a child born through Yibam by Onan and Tamar that would replace Er. But because Onan didn't do that, you now need to take responsibility for Er and Onan. And therefore she needs to have twins. Because the story is, right, it's a double story. It's the story of taking responsibility for Er and taking responsibility for Onan, despite the fact that Onan didn't take responsibility for Er. Right? Yehuda is responsible for the entire family. Right? And therefore you have this replacement, right, or these two heirs, spiritual heirs of Er and Onan. And that seems to be central to this story. Right, not just the generic that you're taking responsibility, but the result will be that if you take responsibility, then you can actually complete the family in a certain sense. Everything that was lost can be brought back, or at least a continuation of that legacy. That's I think part of this. Part of it is as well what Zev mentioned, is that once Yehuda takes responsibility, he has twins and becomes the heir to Yaakov's, right, to the Yaakov leadership, because he becomes like Yitzchak, right? He has twins who are vying for leadership, right? Literally, here you have the vying for leadership where one sticks out his hand, pulls back, right? That they're challenging it, and you put the red string as the symbol of the Bechor on the hand of the one who is the first attempt at Bechor and then loses the Bechor, right? There's a lot. We talked to the twins. There's this red and red and not red and all that imagery, which seems to be telling you that the process Yehuda goes through is the one that is necessary to become the leader in the Abrahamic covenantal relationship. That in order to take the responsibilities of Yitzchak, of Avram Yitzchak, he needed to go through this, and therefore becomes leader. And therefore, it's not accidental that this birth leads to David and Mashiach. Right? Meaning, this is the story of Mashiach, and therefore, the story of saying Yehuda's ability to take responsibility for his family is what made him the king and heir in the deepest sense to the covenantal relationship of Avram. It almost requires him to have twins to mimic Yitzchak. And this has to be a successful Yitzchak story, because despite the fact that Peretz and Zerach, right, sort of vie for the Bechor, neither of them is rejected from the family. There is no real tension in their life that we hear about. And that is a resolution of what has happened, being the ability of brothers to be both vying for the Bechor and still not. First of all, for the Bechor to successfully move to the one who takes it second, which is sort of the resolution of Breishit, but also for there not to ensue fighting from it. Important to that is who else ends up having two sons who vie for the Bechora and don't end up fighting about it and being written out. Yosef, he doesn't have twins, but he has two sons where there's a switch of Bechor, right? Menashe and Ephraim, the hand switch. And again, both of them remain in, both of them remain blessed, right? And Yehuda and Yosef are the two leaders. So this is symbolically very much what Breishit is about. The beginning, when brothers are fighting, and the fights over Bechor become fights over Bechira. And that's what leads to the not, Abrahamic destiny.
Right.
Yosef and Yehuda, by the end of the day, both are capable of having children, two children, who may vie for the Bechora, may even switch the Bechora, but at the end of the day, both remain part of the family, and that is a tshuva, sort of a meta tshuva in Breishit. One more point about the tshuva thing. Again, these are sort of some random points in the story, but clearly the key to the Yehuda story is this transformative ability of tshuva to redeem the entire narrative. So we've talked now about sort of two meta ones, right? One is this Yehuda being the one selling Yosef before the story, and by the end, him being the one standing up for Binyamin, and then that leading to the birth of the heirs of the Davidic, of the Abrahamic covenant, and then the progenitors of the Davidic dynasty, because now once you have brothers who get along, you can have, right, you can have real redemption. And that comes from this tshuva of Yehuda taking responsibility for the family, etc. But there is a small one, which I hadn't noticed until I was listening to the shiur by Rai Silber that I mentioned yesterday, that I think is symbolic of everything that's going on. When Yehuda meets Tamar as the prostitute, does he recognize her?
No.
No, why doesn't he recognize her?
Because she's dressed up as a prostitute.
Covered up.
Correct. Right. Right, ki lo yadaki chalatohi. Right, because she was covered, he didn't know that she was his daughter-in-law. Now, at the end of the story, after he saves her, what does it say? V'lo yasaf od lida'ata. He didn't continue to know her. Which the Mefarshim divide. Does that mean this was the only time he ever slept with her and then he never slept with her again? Or he didn't stop sleeping with her, shot probably being the first one, rather than the second. But leaving that aside, there's a diok here that I hadn't noticed, which is, what does it mean, right? V'lo yasaf od l'da'ata mean?
He didn't know her more. Like
he didn't know her anymore, which what does that imply?
That
he did know her before.
When he slept with her?
Yes, except what does the pasuk say before?
That he didn't know
her. He didn't know her. Now again, it's using yada in different ways, right? Yada here means intimate, and there it meant he just didn't recognize her. Mm-hmm. But if you follow it literally, what does it mean? Before he didn't know her, but now it says he didn't know her again, which means...
He did know.
That retroactively...
He did know.
Right? His intimacy with her becomes one of yadiyah.
Uh-huh.
Right, retroactively, because it's saying he didn't know her again, which implies that the original act of unknowing sex becomes one of legitimate intimacy retroactively. Mm-hmm. Right, that's the implication of it, that he didn't know her, but the pasuk later when he says she doesn't sleep with her again says Yosef od l'data, which means the first time is an act of yediyah, mm-hmm. Which means that what is the parsha really telling you, right, in a local level? That tshuva can't just fix things, it can actually rewrite the past. Mm. Right? It has the power to rewrite the past. That when he slept with her and didn't recognize she was Tamar, it was a zonah. But the fact that he takes ownership by the end makes it that the Torah views it retroactively, is that first act of intimacy was a legitimate act of intimacy, and therefore it can lead to the birth of Yehuda's heirs, of Peretz and Zerach. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a microcosm for the entire story, that it's not just that we're fixing things, right? But that tshuva has the ability to rewrite the story. We're, as it were, rewriting Yaakov and Esav's story in a positive light. Yehuda, by taking responsibility for Binyamin, isn't just doing it right the second time, but is a certain sense rewriting history, where he wasn't the one who sold Yosef. And you'll tell me, well, that's not true, except who says that is true?
The Midrash Mefarshim.
No, Yosef. Right? Because Yosef says, it wasn't you who sold me, it was Hashem. Now you could just say that that's Yosef saying, I don't blame you. But at some level, the message might be, if you really take responsibility and fix it, it can rewrite the past. And yes, you were responsible then, but the fact that you have now fixed it with Binyamin means that God, so to speak, will take ownership of that, and that will become a redemptive process rather than a sinful one. And I think that microcosm that you have here of the ability of tshuva to not just fix the past, but rewrite it, you see in Yosef's perception of the sales story, where once Yehuda has taken ownership of it, he actually goes back and says, it wasn't you, it was God. And he could just be saying that. But at some level, I think that's also the message of the story, is that if you learn to take responsibility, we can go back and rewrite the narrative,
right.
In which case, it really wasn't you, it was really God pulling the strings. So those are some thoughts on Yehuda and Tamar that I didn't say last year.
Cool.
So
yeah,
you know, the basic contours of the story are the same, but the details different. So
thanks.
Okay.